The left side of her brain was crushed as a result of the impact.
Somebody here had taken a lot of time, had either carried out a grudge or had some vendetta that they were paying her back for.
What was she feeling? What was she experiencing, and how scared she must have been somebody would be attacking her like that?
The kind of person that would violate a body after death has a deep rage and a hatred toward women. The pressure is terrible. If you don't catch the guy, you know he's going to kill again.
There's a real possibility that this could be a serial killer.
Every murder is a mystery. But a victim's body is a sea of evidence. Every fiber is a clue. Every wound, a piece of the puzzle. The medical examiner holds the key to unlock their stories and catch a killer. This is Secrets of the Morgue.
Bellevue was a much more sophisticated town in the 1990s, especially in the downtown core. It was more of a ritzy place than it had been before.
Bellevue is known like the wealthy town between, you know, Seattle, Tacoma, and stuff like that. So people went there for the bars. It was a nice place to live.
But in the early days of summer, upscale Bellevue falls victim to shocking violence.
I receive a call from the station to go to the Black Angus. It was a steakhouse, quite a hangout for the younger set. They tell me that an employee bringing out the trash discovered a body. I see the body of a naked young woman lying on her back right next to the dumpster. There's a pine cone between her hands, which are on her stomach, and her feet are together. She's bruised and battered, it looks like. Her head is turned to one side, and there is a plastic, like a coffee cup, lid covering one eye. That's the first time I'd ever seen the victim's pose. It was posed that way.
Detectives call the medical examiner, Dr. Donald Ray, to the crime scene.
My view is that the autopsy actually begins at the scene of death. And so that's where your examination really begins.
Dr. Ray has performed more than 5,000 autopsies and helped work both the Ted Bundy and Green River Killer cases.
I think I'm a meticulous pathologist. My motivation or goal is to do the best examination for the family. You never know when you make your observations whether or not that observation is going to be critical in the overall investigation.
Investigators need to learn everything they can about the victim in the alley.
I estimate the time of death, taking into account the ambient temperature. The body cools at a certain rate, and there's usually a 1.5 degree change in body temperature per hour of death. I estimated that she died between 2:30 and 5:30.
It would have been quiet in those early morning hours, but detectives are struck by where they find Jane Doe's body.
Bodies are normally dumped in a hidden location. In my opinion, the killer wanted this to be found. He wanted the statement to be made.
Victims who have been killed and posed in a degrading way, that tells investigators right away that this is a sexually motivated killer.
I thought he was taunting us.
Detective Hansen is determined to bring the perpetrator to justice.
In my heart, I'm a hunter of hunters. I'm a hunter of predators. I'm the kind of detective that I would put my hands into my pockets and walk through a scene and absorb the whole thing. Sometimes I can almost feel or hear the screams of the victims.
Investigators are hoping a thorough examination of the body can help point them towards the killer.
First of all, you're looking for trace evidence. The collection of hairs and fibers becomes very important. We also take multiple samples of the mouth and the anus and vagina.
These samples, including traces of semen, are sent to the FBI. But in 1990, DNA analysis is in its infancy.
The results can often take months because of the backlog at the FBI lab.
Dr. Ray turns his attention to the cause of death.
This woman had multiple injuries. She had some marks on the surface of the skin over the neck. And the conclusion was, I think this could be the result of manual strangulation. Well, I was impressed with the extent of the injuries to the head, with the fractures and the damage to the brain. This is a very violent injury to the head, which is the result of a blunt object impacting the skull.
At the end of his external examination, Dr. Ray makes a disturbing observation.
The amount of bleeding that you see on the surface of the skin is a reflection of whether that injury was before death or after death. In this case, there were some injuries inflicted after death.
Then, another horrific detail is discovered.
I noticed vaginal penetration because of the tearing and the bruising. My conclusion was this was likely the result of post-mortem insertion.
A killer who will mutilate and have sex with the deceased is somebody who gets a thrill out of controlling the person, who is excited by the aspect of having total and utter complete control over them.
We're dealing with not only a sick individual, we're dealing with a very dangerous individual.
With the victim's identity a mystery, detectives reach out to the public for help.
We sent out a teletype describing the victim as a Jane Doe and asking for any of these surrounding agencies for any missing persons that might match the victim's description. I also took pictures of her jewelry. She had a distinctive necklace on her neck. I took pictures of that as well. This was also later released to the newspaper.
And that's a very difficult situation for any homicide investigator because you need to know who your victim is. That's sort of ground zero. That's where you begin.
Clock is ticking. It's working against us because we don't know who the victim is, so we don't know how to look for the suspect. After 4 days, we get a break in the case. A woman who was the victim's roommate identified the photograph of the necklace. We got the dental records from the mother, and the identification was made by the medical examiner's office. We now know that the victim is Marianne Polreich.
Police are determined to find justice for this innocent young woman.
Marianne Polreich was from a rural community in South King County. She had moved to the Bellevue area, where she was working and living with a girlfriend in an apartment. She was friendly, she was outgoing. There was an innocence about her, knowing that added to the mysteriousness of her as a character and what had led to her death.
Detective Hansen hopes to retrace Marianne's last steps. Her roommate suggests a local hangout.
We found Marianne's car parked in Papagayo's parking lot. Papagayo's cantina was probably a 10-minute drive from the Black Angus where her body was found. In doing interviews with the employees and the patrons of Papagayo's cantina, we learned that Marianne Polreich was a regular there, especially on Friday and Saturday nights.
Detectives want to know who Marianne was with the night she disappeared.
Any homicide, you start with the victim and you work your way out. But you always start that circle very small. You can always expand it. And you eliminate people as you go. They're either in the investigation or they're out of the investigation, either by way of alibi or documentary evidence.
There were a few people that would say they remembered her being at a certain table most often. but she moved around a lot. She often would leave the bar with a guy and come back. So it was tracking this down to a particular person was difficult.
But they do identify a close friend of Marianne's, Steve Kowalczyk. They hope he can shed light on Marianne's movements in and around the bar.
Most of our evenings that we spent on either a Friday or Saturday night, we would go to Papagayo's. What we would do often is we would bring alcohol with us in our car, and we just call it kind of tailgating in the parking lot. We didn't have a lot of money, so we didn't want to spend a lot of money on the drinks. So we would just go out and we'd exit the bar a couple times, go to the car, get a drink or something like that, and go back in. Going to the bars felt very comfortable. For her, it was a means of kind of exploring, getting out, and just, you know, finding who she was. And she was very much enjoying it. She was having fun. So we had a very close friendship.
Detectives questioned Steve about his alibi that night.
When Mary went missing, I could explain to them I was with my brother and his wife. We were watching a movie that night.
With Steve in the clear, investigators searched the bar where Marianne was last seen, looking for clues.
A purse was found. It was a black purse, a fairly small one, and there was a checkbook in there with her name on it. The fact that her purse was found at the bar would have indicated to me that she left the bar temporarily, maybe to go out and have a drink with a guy, but we couldn't find anybody that saw her leave.
Detectives fear the trail for Marianne's killer could grow cold.
I feel a sense of obligation to her family. Marianne herself is gone, but she left behind survivors who need closure, and it's up to us to provide the closure. We're pretty much working 7 days a week to solve this. We were very frustrated.
As police struggle with Marianne's murder, the citizens of Bellevue are shocked by another similar crime.
I learned of a second murder, became kind of a concern. I think people are growing a little scared and stuff at the clubs.
Citizens in my town, the women are not safe. There's a killer on the loose.
Detective John Hansen is on the way to a second murder scene in a quiet Bellevue neighborhood.
This is a kid's neighborhood. The front door was not locked. It was that kind of a neighborhood.
The victim is identified as 35-year-old Carol Beath, a bartender and single mother of two.
I see a body that is in bed that's been mutilated horribly, and there is blood spatter all over the walls and the ceiling, and her body has been desecrated. Again, a body has been posed. There is a rifle barrel inserted into her vagina. Her legs are spread. She's had nothing on except red high-heeled shoes. All over the head, there's these impressions, these blows have been inflicted by some kind of a tool, and their head has been wrapped in plastic. Oh, I was shocked. I've never seen anything like that. My impression was that the suspect was stating that this woman is an immoral person, and he is showing her for what she really is, and he wants everybody to see this and to basically to destroy her and her reputation.
With two women brutally killed within 7 weeks, police question whether the two murders may be related.
You have two posed bodies that have been murdered, and there was a beating or brutalization of the body post-mortem. In Marianne Polreich, the body was in a public place. In the case of Carol Beath, it was in a private home, which indicated to me that the killer knew her.
Police interview Carol's daughter.
She found her mother like that and called her father. The father came, he told me that he came in, he saw the body, he made a phone call from the bedroom. I learned from the ex-husband that the rifle was his. She had kept it in the house along with another rifle, kept both of those under her bed. Her ex-husband was not considered a suspect because of the fact that he came quickly, he called us right away. He answered our questions, very badly shaken. All of his responses were completely appropriate.
Carol's daughter may have caught a glimpse of the murderer.
She said that at about 4:30 in the morning, she heard a noise. She saw the figure of a man walking down the hallway toward her mother's bedroom or away from it, and figured it was Mike Sewell, the boyfriend, because he sometimes would come over at night.
Dr. Ray performs the autopsy on Carol. Police know that if the killer left a clue, Dr. Ray will find it.
The body is scanned with a ultraviolet light in a dark room because different samples can fluoresce. We may not be able to see them on the body, but if you use ultraviolet lamp, they stand out because they reflect light. We're very conscious of trace evidence. We're very conscious of taking samples of head hair, pubic hair.
The carefully collected hairs will need to be sent to a lab for analysis. Dr. Ray examines the violence done to the body.
There were two wounds to the palm, which would indicate that she was alive at the time that she was assaulted. There were fractures of the two ribs on the left side of the chest. Impact to the torso and on the right side would cause enough damage to lacerate or tear the liver. Now, the rifle was identified to be 5 or 6 inches insertion. The left side of her brain was crushed as a result of the impact injuries to the head. The cause of death was a result of the head injuries.
Dr. Ray also determines time of death to be approximately 4 a.m., around the time Carol's daughter saw someone in the hall.
When you deal with a homicide where the suspect and the victim had a relationship, you will often find that there is a far more violent emotional mechanism of death. There's emotion, there's rage, and you can see it in the autopsy. The body may be posed in a degrading way to demean them one last time.
Police begin the search for Carol's boyfriend, Mike.
Mike Sewell was a divorcee with a couple of kids of his own, worked for a construction company, drove a blue Corvette. I learned from witnesses that a blue Corvette was seen going through the neighborhood on that street around 4 a.m. There aren't that many Corvettes around, let alone blue Corvettes. We get hold of Mike Sewell. He denied having seen her in the last couple of days.
But when detectives press Mike on his alibi, his mood changes.
He was resistant and combative with us in our trying to nail it down. He was looking more and more like some guy, the person responsible.
As investigators piece together Carol's final hours, they discover that Mike wasn't the only man in her life.
We interviewed her co-workers. We learned that after Carol got off work, she went to meet John, this new boyfriend of hers.
Detectives tracked down John through Carol's friends.
John was a bartender. After they closed up, they went out in his car in a parking lot, and they had sex in the car, and then she went home. He said it was about 2:15 in the morning when he last saw Carol after she left to go home. But the fact that he had had sex with her that morning would not fit with killing her brutally a couple hours later.
For investigators, Carol's boyfriend, Mike, is the strongest suspect.
When we mentioned to him about Carol having these other relationships, he began to pound the table. He began to go practically berserk. There was a strong possibility he fell into a jealous rage when he found out about another one of Carol's lovers. And we wanted Mike to submit to certain tests to establish whether his guilt or his innocence. He refused. There was more ground I wanted to cover by interrogation and interview, but he had come to the point where he said he wanted an attorney. We had to stop. We were pretty unanimous that this guy had to be cleared one way or another before we move forward.
But 3 weeks later, a third murder is reported. King County police receive a call from a frantic couple who believes something horrible has happened to their basement tenant. The victim is 24-year-old Andrea Randy Levine. Veteran King County Detective Larry Peterson is dispatched to the scene.
Randy had moved into that apartment, I believe, about a year prior. She was a pretty normal 24-year-old. She was a receptionist at a firm in Bellevue. Go into the bedroom where she was first seen by the landlord. She was on her bed. She was sort of spread-eagled. Her left arm was on top of a book. Something about the joys of sex. She had some very severe head wounds. There must have been numerous bowls because there was a repeated blood spray on the wall where somebody had swung and swung again. On her telephone machine, there were a series of telephone calls, and I think the last one was a call from her mother saying, "Randy, I thought you'd call me this weekend. You haven't. Please call."
As the medical examiner for Bellevue and King County, Dr. Ray is the only person familiar with all three murders.
There were a lot of common denominators. Three murder victims that looked the same in terms of the unusual features and the posing of the victims. There are similarities here that are unexplainable.
Dr. Ray confirms the town's worst fears.
There's a real possibility we could be looking at a serial killer.
Investigators fear Marianne Polreich, Carol Beath, and Randy Levine may have been murdered by the same sadistic killer.
The pressure is terrible because you're feeling responsible if you don't catch the guy and he kills again. And you know he's going to kill again, and you don't know where he is or even who he is, but you know it's going to happen.
Dr. Ray begins his autopsy on Randy. His detailed study of all three victims reveals a key pattern.
There are 15 blows. These are the typical blows associated with a blunt impact causing the underlying injuries to the skull. She had multiple stab wounds all over her body. My conclusion was that many of these were the result of postmortem injury. It's very similar to the other two cases with extensive fractures of the skull and damage to the underlying brain.
Dr. Ray's work proves to detectives they're looking for a single perpetrator.
We realize that these three homicides were interconnected. There is a person out there who has done three homicides, and as long as he is free and at large, he likely will commit another.
It appears that the killer is acting with cold, calculated rage.
There are no fingerprints, and Randy's, the suspect, actually wiped things down afterwards or wore gloves. Well, there was not any signs of forced entry, but it obviously shows that nobody had to force the door to come in. It could conceivably be somebody who just found an open door. It could conceivably be a known person who was welcomed in by Randy. All indications point to the suspect coming into the house while she is in bed sleeping. So he obviously went there to do what he did and came prepared to accomplish his means. Somebody here had taken a lot of time and had either carried out a grudge or had some vendetta that they were paying her back for.
To determine who Randy may have been with, detectives turned to Dr. Ray to establish her time of death.
She had come to the ambient temperature in the room, so that's likely that she was dead for 2 or 3 days.
It gives me a starting point to try to determine her whereabouts at about that time.
Detective Peterson interviews Randy's friends about the last time they saw her.
Randy left the tavern in Bridal Trail sometime in the early morning hours, 12 to 1 o'clock, 1:30, presumably to drive home by herself. At about 5:30 that Friday morning, her landlord was aware of a disturbance in the backyard. He let his dog out, and he looked out the back door. The dog went chasing after someone, and he explained he saw a figure running from his house, wearing dark clothing, vaulted a fence, and was gone. He called the police. Police came over. There was no breaking and entry that they were aware of, and it was dismissed as a prowler call. I believe the prowler that was seen is very likely the suspect who caused the injuries and death of Randy.
Randy's boyfriend is a person of interest.
She had a boyfriend, Brent, who she had dated, I guess, for a period of time. Found out that they were planning on a trip to the San Juan Islands that weekend. Brent is the last person that I am aware of who saw Randy alive. You always have to make sure that you can clear those people close to the victim. Call it gut feelings, call it conversations with them, call it conversations with other people who knew both Randy and him and their relationship. But there was enough to take him away from somebody who was thought to be a prime suspect.
Police consider whether suspects in the previous murders could be connected to Randy's death. They bring in Carol Beath's boyfriend, Mike, for more questioning.
He came in with his attorney, and he submitted to the blood samples, the saliva samples, anything else that we wanted for lab comparison. He cooperated with us, and he was completely cleared, and then we moved on. You know, this is something that weighs on you very, very heavily. Our bag of tools is pretty much spent, and we're frustrated with not getting anywhere.
But an intriguing detail in Dr. Ray's autopsy report gives investigators a thin thread to follow.
There was some bruising around one of her fingers.
I talked to Dr. Ray and confirmed that an abrasion on her finger could conceivably have been caused by somebody pulling and forcing a ring off that finger.
Detective Peterson invites one of Randy's friends over to her apartment to look for that ring.
She's aware of a ring that was given to Randy by Randy's sister-in-law, and it was a very prized possession. And we knew it was a gold ring. It had an amethyst stone in it. As she's looking through Randy's possession, and she says that her ring is not here. Well, the ring is very important. It's something that was taken, and serial killers quite often take something to bring back with them and to reflect on what they have done.
As detectives begin the task of tracking down the missing ring, they look for what connects the three victims.
There were white women of about the same age. The one thing they had in common was that they went to the same bars in the same area of Bellevue. The clientele is numerous, and they're very fluid. And they exchange partners back and forth. They go there to pick each other up, and relationships are formed and broken constantly. So it's a very complicated maze as far as tracking movements. It's become very, very painstaking work.
Painstaking, but urgent. The killer could strike again at any time.
Serial killers often become more brazen over time because they learn from the mistakes that they've made in previous kills.
It gave me sleepless nights to think that the killer would be on the loose and could hurt and kill other people until he was caught.
The brutal homicides of Marianne Polreich, Carol Beath, and Randy Levine have rocked Bellevue, Washington. Police believe they are facing a serial killer and are desperately trying to crack the case.
You have to sustain yourself with the idea that you can interview 99 potential witnesses and not get anywhere, and on the 100th one or the 101st one, you get a bingo, and that makes it worth it.
2 weeks after Randy Levine is killed, a woman calls 911.
There's a prowler. He was trying to get into her apartment, and he was angry, and she's in fear of her life. He saw her on the phone calling the police, so he left.
Police rush to the woman's home and search the area. They locate a potential witness nearby.
The officer found him in the parking lot in a red car. He explained to the officer he's living there with friends. And then another officer came up and informed the first officer the man has outstanding warrants.
The man in the car is George Russell, who had been recently arrested for impersonating a police officer.
He was picked up, he's flashing a badge in an altercation downtown. In the pat down, they found a gun on him. He's illegally carrying a weapon.
Police run the serial number of the gun and make a surprising connection.
The gun is stolen from a neighbor of Randy Levine's.
George Russell becomes a key suspect, but police don't want to show their hand, so they only arrest him on his previous warrants. During questioning, investigators bring up Randy's murder.
George Russell had said that he knew Randy Levine, and apparently he had gone to her place.
They ask Russell where he was when Randy was killed.
Russell and three of his friends stayed at a Motel 6 in the Totem Lake area on the night that Randy was killed. The motel was about 1 mile from Randy Levine's home.
Russell denies knowing the second victim, Carol Beath, but admits to being at Papagayo's with a friend the night Marianne Polreich was murdered.
He was very cooperative, very cocksure that he was there strictly as somebody who might help us solve a crime that he knew nothing about.
For detectives, pieces of the puzzle are coming together.
George Russell was narrowed down to the local bar scene because so many people knew him and knew who he was. So that was what in common he had with the three women. They all had gone to those same bars that he did.
We asked him whether or not he would agree to give some body samples fluid. And then he became very irate and said, I think I want my attorney.
Police obtain a court order to get blood, saliva, and hair samples from George Russell. But the lab moves too slowly for police.
We can't hold him indefinitely. We've got a time limit, and we don't meet that time limit, he walks.
Investigators track down George Russell's friend who was with him at the bar.
Smitty McLean was at Papagayo's the night Marianne Polreich disappeared. George Russell asked him to borrow his truck to take somebody somewhere and he would bring it right back. He gave him the keys to it. George was gone with the truck for almost 10 hours.
Detectives believe Marianne and George Russell left the bar together in Smitty's truck.
And Smitty even waited after the bar closed for George to show up. Finally never did. And then later the next day, George brings the truck back and makes an excuse that he was driving around trying to find Smitty and couldn't find him. Smitty smelled that the truck had an awful smell to it, very nauseating smell. George Russell explained to Smitty that he had clam chowder that he threw up, made him very sick. Smitty doubted this because the clam chowder is white. These are red stains. Smitty revealed that he had taken the floor mats out and put them in his garage because he couldn't kill the smell. Well, he did not clean them. We thought it would be a very lucky break for us.
Police send samples from the truck seats and floor mats to the state crime lab for analysis. They will be compared to the samples carefully collected during Marianne's autopsy.
At the time we're doing the examination, these samples may not seem important, but 6 months later, it may become very important.
The lab results return.
Fibers that were found on Marianne Polreich's body matched the fibers that were found in Smitty McLean's truck. The stains revealed that there was blood that had been tracked to Marianne Polreich. First thought is this is unraveling, this is our guy.
The blood is Marianne's type, and the fibers prove she was in contact with the truck. It's compelling evidence, but detectives need more to secure a conviction.
He did commit 3 murders. We're convinced of this. We haven't got total proof to charge him for all 3 yet. But there is nothing at all that would keep him from having a 4th victim if he were allowed to be out of jail and have freedom to roam.
We were at a great fear that if Judge Russell got out again, he would not only disappear, he would kill again, and he would keep killing.
Investigators believe they have caught the serial killer of Marianne Polreich, Carol Beath, and Randy Levine. But without more evidence, he could go free.
If you had a chalkboard you can picture with a bunch of circles and a line with our suspect Russell at the bottom, there'd be all kinds of lines coming back to him.
Just one day before Russell must be released on his other charges, results from the DNA analysis arrive.
I call it a miracle when these come in, when they do, answer to prayer.
Russell's DNA has been compared to samples taken during Marianne's autopsy.
The DNA evidence showed George Russell was likely the donor of the semen. The DNA evidence came in just under the wire.
As a result, George Russell is charged with the murder of Marianne Polreich.
There was great satisfaction having gotten one. We had 2 to go.
Detectives are still trying to track down Randy's missing ring. If they can connect it to George Russell, they'll know that he took it from her finger.
I became aware of a female that Russell had dated. And at one time had been stood up by George Russell. And she had come in contact with George after this date that was missed. He offered her and gave her a ring as sort of an appeasement to say, I'm sorry, I wasn't where I should have been.
The ring has since been sold, but Detective Peterson traces it to a pawn shop in the Florida Keys.
We found what we think is the ring. Now I have to find somebody who can positively tell me this is the ring that Randy had. Randy Levine's father lived in Florida, and the sister-in-law who had originally given the ring to Randy lived in Florida. So they went to the police station and were shown the ring and positively identified it as being Randy's ring. We have a chain of evidence that's indisputable as to whose ring it is, the path it traveled, and connecting it to George Russell. A piece of the puzzle is put together.
With 2 down, now detectives need to link Russell to their last victim, Carol Beath.
It was the thought of the prosecutor's office, if they filed all 3 together, the likelihood of getting a conviction was greater.
They test a few traces of hair found on Carol's body and bed.
They're able to say it's a negroid hair, but they cannot say that it belongs to our suspect. It belongs to a person of that race.
To prove that Russell killed Carol Beath and committed all 3 murders, investigators highlight the similar pattern of death revealed by Dr. Ray.
There are so many similarities among the 3 victims. You have damage to the skull with multiple fractures and underlying brain damage. These were all blunt impact type injuries inflicted after death. There was laceration of the liver. There seemed to be an attempt to pose the body. The degree of the injury was really not what is ordinarily found.
The fine details of the injuries Dr. Ray gave us helped in understanding the primary characteristics of these 3 murders.
We had sufficient information to convince the prosecutor that George was a viable suspect, that they could take the trial and charge for 2 counts of aggravated and 1 count of first-degree murder.
Russell is formally charged with the murder of Marianne Polreich, Carol Beath, and Randy Levine. He pleads not guilty. Steve Kowalczyk attends the trial to learn more about what happened to his friend Marianne.
They had conversations that night, and George, again, come out to the truck, let's have a drink. Nothing unusual for us, we did that all the time. So being kind of lured out there under those pretenses and stuff like that, she would be completely unaware. You know, anything could happen to her. Then you go through what was she feeling? You know, what was she experiencing and how scared she must have been, you know, that somebody would be attacking her like that.
After Russell killed Mary Ann, investigators believe he developed a taste for murder.
I believe that George Russell was targeting Carol Beath. He had his eye on her. He came into her house. He just came down the hallway with a flashlight and closed the door, and he went straight into the attack.
Russell and Randy Levine knew each other. Russell admitted he had been to her house before.
He showed up uninvited at Randy's house and tried to get in or tried to befriend her and was rejected by her, telling him to get out of here. You're not invited. So I think that his final actions were as a result of being rejected by Randy.
Mary Ann's friend Steve is there when the jury reads the verdict.
They stand up and you're just sitting there. I didn't think the wave of emotion would hit me as it did, but when they, you know, count one, count two, count three, when they're going guilty, 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 it was just a explosion of emotions. I can't describe it. You know, we knew it was him, but now everyone else knew it was him. It was extremely emotional.
Russell receives two sentences of life in prison without the possibility of parole and one sentence of nearly 29 years in prison.
Dr. Ray's role and the role of a medical examiner's office was crucial in solving the case of the George Russell murders.
It is definitely a partnership. It is something that is very important to us. Dr. Ray is helpful always. He's a wonderful pathologist and a good man.
It was certainly some satisfaction. I've said that the best thing that we can do in this kind of work is to do a good examination. As a medical examiner, I think that came through pretty well.
Thank you.